the Declaration of Independence itself is just being trampled on. The Constitution is being trampled on just flagrantly, and nothing's being done about it.
The battle over who may vote, contentious through American history and still today. You're listening to a Humankind special, The Right to Vote. I'm David Freudberg. Often heated, sometimes contested, and widely seen as negative to the point of nauseating, our electoral system remains, for better or worse, the very foundation of American democracy. It was the method devised by the nation's wig-wearing 18th century founders to safeguard their experimental country from the threat of monarchy and dictatorship. But at times throughout the ensuing course of American history, the right of citizens to vote has been bitterly disputed.
It was just scandalous about how you could literally be killed for registering to vote.
Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons teaches religion and African American studies at the University of Florida in Gainesville. In 1964, at age 19, she worked in Mississippi to help secure the right of all Americans to vote.
Black people were told, under no circumstances should you attempt to register to vote.
Who would tell them?
The election officials, the sheriffs. I mean, this was known by every black person in the state that you cannot register to vote. You cannot vote. I mean, this was a life and death situation. And, you know,
And had people been harmed if they attempted?
Absolutely. I mean, not only harmed, people had been killed.
The Voting Rights Act, signed in 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson, attempted to enforce the Constitution's 15th Amendment, which a century earlier had guaranteed the right of African Americans to vote following the abolition of slavery. But to this day, a debate rages over who in America may have unfettered access to the ballot box.
Hi there. Can I enter the polling place here?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's primary day in Illinois. I'm in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood, where a race for local state representative seems to have captured the most attention. But voter turnout has been light so far here in the large new field house at Haas Park, where young children are scampering around the playground on a chilly morning.
You are in the 41st precinct. We're 7, they're 41.
Well, it's now at the election board.
Well, it's the same website building. It's just down the hall.
On the other side.
Yeah.
Barbara did find her way to the right room for her precinct. She's an early retiree who did computer work at the University of Illinois.
I've been voting since I was 18, since I was eligible to vote. I've voted every election. I think maybe I missed one in my whole life.
May I ask your current age?
I'm 56 now.
And why do you make such a religious commitment to voting?
While I'm very cynical, I still believe that this is really the only tool I've got to express my views and get my views out there.
I said, I have 20 minutes. I'm going to run there. Literally ran here, but...
You're in your running suit.
Yes, I literally ran here. I just think I'm young. I'm 24, so I think it's important because a lot of this stuff is affecting me now since I graduated college and I'm working and stuff, and you don't realize it affects you until you are in the community, you know.
What kind of things are affecting you that you would hope to impact by voting?
Well, definitely the education and also like health care and things like that are affecting me personally. And I think, well, what's one vote going to do? But one vote can turn into several votes, which can turn into the right person being elected. So that's why I came.
And your name?
Is Demokratia. My name means democracy. Yeah, I'm Greek, so.
Your name is Demokratia.
My name is I was born here, but my parents were born in Greece, and they named me Demokratia after my mom's mom.
Like voting in Athens 2,500 years ago, which excluded women and slaves, voting in early America did not allow participation by everyone, but as far back as the 1600s, there were formal elections in the colonies.
And the voting that was done was usually done was called, what was called viva voce, was not with a written ballot. People gathered on an election day and in one form or another uttered their preferences, or sometimes just uttered, yes, they acquiesced to this, and they did it out loud.
Alexander Kasar, author of The Right to Vote, is professor of history and public policy at Harvard.
Most people are quite surprised to hear, you know, for example, that there is nothing about the right to vote in the Constitution. And there was certainly a presumption among most of the framers, not all, but most, that those people who would be voting would be of the better sort. Not necessarily an aristocracy, but it would not include the poor. It would certainly be male, and in most cases was presumed to be white.
So at America's inception, when the founders' democratic ideals symbolized a great leap from monarchy, the majority of people living in the United States were actually disenfranchised. Only gradually would certain groups gain the right to vote, often then provoking a backlash. In fact, for a brief period starting in the late 1700s, women were allowed to vote in New Jersey, a right that the legislature then rescinded in 1807. It would be a very long wait before the Constitution eventually enfranchised all female Americans. Colgate University historian Faye Dudden.
When women began the struggle for the vote about the middle of the 19th century, married women had no right to own property. You couldn't own the property that you brought into the marriage. You couldn't own your own wages. Women certainly never had a jury of their peers. Women were taxed without representation.
Another group of citizens generally barred from voting in early America were people who didn't own a minimum amount of real estate. If you merely rented, you weren't allowed to vote. Benjamin Franklin opposed this rule, but he was an exception among the country's founders. Alex Kasar.
In the beliefs of a number of the upper classes, there was this sense that they wanted people who were voting to be exercising their independent judgment. They should not be improperly influenced by any other person. And thus they had to have sufficient economic means to do that. There's a lot of talk about demagogues coming in, about sort of charismatic demagogic leaders who will manipulate the poor. At the same time, there is a fear of poor people, a concern that if property does not have special rights, then the propertyless will seize the property of the wealthy.
And there are echoes of this concern in today's debate over income inequality and wealth redistribution. The requirement that voters own property was lifted in the early 1800s, but a dispute would soon erupt over an entirely different kind of property, the ownership of human beings as slaves. After North and South clashed in the U.S. Civil War, it opened the question of voting rights for newly freed slaves. Alex Kasar.
One thing that happened was that there were a lot of African Americans during the war, from the beginning of the war, from the North, who actually fought alongside Union soldiers. And there was a notion which goes back fairly deep into our culture and European cultures, that someone who fights for a country should have the right to vote, and that these men had earned it. They had risked their lives.
Wartime has a way of shaking society to its core. And on several occasions, the expansion of civil rights in America has followed periods of military battle. 5 years after the Civil War ended, the Constitution's 15th Amendment was ratified. It barred states from denying a man the right to vote based on race or whether he'd previously been a slave. This meant a million freedmen, although not women, were suddenly enfranchised. And for a time, that reshaped the political landscape of the South.
During Reconstruction, black men were able to vote.
University of Florida Professor Zohara Simmons.
You had a number of black men elected to office in state legislatures. You had congresspeople elected. And so this was the first thing that the Klan, which began to be organized during this time, they said, we have to take the franchise away from these people. And so from that point, they had been adamant, black people are not going to vote down here, because that means they will have power.
And in this period, African-American voters did exercise their new electoral clout. They created school systems for black children and, to pay for them, raised taxes on everybody. In reaction, black elected officials and black voters were counterattacked.
They literally, in some cases, tarred and feathered people who had been elected. We have some cases of lynchings, burning people's homes down. I mean, beatings. This is all documented. I mean, it was a reign of terror to make sure that people who were voting, and of course they were only men at that point, that they couldn't vote anymore. I mean, you were going to be killed if you attempted to do it, or beaten. Women, children were lynched. I mean, it was horrible.
There's a key turning point in the story.
Historian Alex Kasar.
Which is in 1890, as the stories are mounting about voter suppression in the South, Congress considers a piece of legislation which basically authorized sending agents of the federal government into the South to protect the voting rights of African Americans. The Lodge Force Bill fails to pass by a very, very narrow vote. And that marks the end of a Northern commitment to actively protecting the voting rights of African Americans.
Meanwhile, a different population was fighting for its place at the American table. The waves of millions of newcomers arriving on boats, mostly from Europe and a smaller influx from China. And in this case, many Northerners felt their established social order was being disrupted.
There is a concern as they watch increasing numbers of immigrants come into the country whom they regard as ill-educated and ill-equipped for democracy. The Irish first, and these northern states start passing laws to make it more difficult for immigrants to vote. New York State passes an English language literacy law in 1921. This is New York, the home of immigrants.
Ellis Island.
Right. Welcome to the United States, but it's fine if you can speak Yiddish and Italian, but you can't vote. Those laws remain on the books and enforced into the 1960s.
Listening to The Right to Vote, a Humankind Special. I'm David Freudberg. To obtain an audio download or a CD of this documentary, to hear portions of interviews not included in the program, and to access related educational resources, please visit humanmedia.org. At the turn of the 20th century, in America, the world's largest democracy, a majority of adults were effectively prevented from voting, mostly blacks in the Deep South and women in much of the nation. Although the Constitution now explicitly enfranchised black men, women of any color were not federally entitled to vote, a right their suffrage movement had been seeking for decades. Historian Faye Dudden is author of Fighting Chance.
The right to vote was the most radical of all of the rights that were talked about at the first Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wanted to propose that one. All the others passed unanimously. Lucretia Mott told her, don't do that. That's too radical. You'll make us ridiculous. But Frederick Douglass was there, the great abolitionist leader. He encouraged Stanton to ask for the vote. He said, you will never get your freedom unless you have this kind of power.
Stanton's bold resolution passed unanimously, and it would galvanize the fledgling campaign for women's rights. But in those years preceding outbreak of the Civil War, the nation's agenda would take up other matters.
And the whole movement was suspended. And the war smashed slavery. The one thing that they all were giving great priority to was finally taken down. And it seemed that this was a moment in Reconstruction where there was tremendous opportunity, because the question of the right to vote was everywhere, with the freed slaves in the South being their enfranchisement being widely discussed. So they thought, here's our moment. We have a fighting chance.
But friction started to develop between Elizabeth Cady Stanton's suffrage movement and efforts to enfranchise the former slaves. An abolitionist leader declared this is the Negro's hour, and that meant delaying the question of granting women the right to vote. But Stanton pushed back, resorting to racial epithets and insisting that enfranchisement of African American men could result in what she called fearful outrages.
Now, fearful outrages in 19th century euphemism, that meant rape. She was predicting that black male voters would be tantamount to rapists. They had the power of the vote and women did not. This was a really slimy thing to say. People call it the myth of the black rapist. It was to become the chief cover story for lynching in the postbellum South. So the fact that she was willing to buy into that and repeat that story was particularly distressing.
The constitutional amendment that ultimately passed would extend the franchise to black men but exclude all women. As the 19th century drew to a close, though, female citizens were gradually gaining a foothold in the voting booth. According to Harvard historian Alex Kasar, enfranchisement of women began in several western states, then spread to some urban areas at a time of rapid cultural change.
The increasing number and proportion of women who are educated, the increasing number of women who are living in cities, where organizing politically and organizing in an activist way is possible. That with changes in the nature of American industry, more and more women are going into the workplace.
Neither Elizabeth Cady Stanton nor her political partner Susan B. Anthony would live to see their long dream of women's suffrage fully realized. But their cause was advanced by other forces at play. Faye Dutton.
Frances Willard built the Women's Christian Temperance Union into an organization of hundreds of thousands of women. Ultimately, Frances Willard convinced her membership, sort of nice temperance ladies, to say, I think I need the vote because I want to use it to end demon rum.
The Constitution's 18th Amendment, which ushered in prohibition of alcohol sales, took effect in January 1920. 7 months later saw ratification of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed that a citizen's right to vote could not be denied or abridged based on gender.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
I was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1944.
Professor Zohara Simmons at the University of Florida in Gainesville.
So it was very much during the Jim Crow era, and Memphis was a Jim Crow town. Almost anything you can think of was separate and unequal. The schools, the churches, the buses. I grew up where we had to sit on the back of the bus, and even then, if the bus became crowded and there were whites who were standing, you had to give up your seat, even though you were in the colored section. Libraries were not open to black people. You couldn't try on clothes because, of course, if a black person had put on a shoe, no white person was going to put that same shoe on. There were no elected officials that were black. There were no police persons. So, you know, it was apartheid.
I mean, at a certain level, looking back now, decades later, it almost seems absurd.
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, when I teach this stuff, the students, it's like they can't even comprehend what you're talking about. It's just so crazy to them. you know.
In the early 1960s, Zohara Simmons moved to Atlanta to attend Spelman College. Her church there was pastored by Reverend Ralph Abernathy, the longtime associate of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. She would become active in voter registration efforts.
My getting involved in the civil rights movement was quite a journey because, first of all, Spelman College threatened us, saying from the time we got there, you were not to get involved. And given that I was there on full scholarship and loans, I was really terrified of losing my scholarship, and that's exactly what they told us they would do to us.
And we should note that Spelman is a traditionally African-American college.
Absolutely, yes. They saw themselves as at the mercy of the white establishment. And so they saw themselves as possibly being harmed if their students were participating.
Nevertheless, you made a decision that you were going to venture into the civil rights movement. What so drew you, especially considering the high stakes for you?
There were a lot of factors, faculty influence, church influence, and then I think most importantly, the young people who were my age, who were putting everything on the line and making no bones about how they looked at those of us who were not willing to do the same. So I start getting involved little by little. I was terrified of being arrested.
At a young age, Zohara Simmons had to wrestle with a tough personal decision. But she couldn't escape the feeling that somehow, in spite of the risks, she was being called to participate. And it led her to volunteer for a daring project to register black citizens to vote in Mississippi.
My folks were totally opposed to my involvement.
Why?
Oh, they were terrified. I mean, for them, marching and going to jail, I mean, they just thought, you're asking for death. I mean, so this was something that they were terribly afraid for me. And they put a lot of pressure on me not to go. And of course, while I was in Memphis growing up, I had heard of the horrors of Mississippi. So it was like everybody thought that Mississippi was the worst hellhole for black people in this country.
So what horrors about Mississippi had you heard?
Oh, I'd heard about lynchings. I'd heard that people were literally imprisoned on plantations where they were not able to leave. They were under armed guards, that people would escape from Mississippi and their first stop would be Memphis because, as you know, Memphis is right on the border with the Mississippi Delta. So I had heard all these stories growing up because my grandmother was very aware of this stuff. And so when they learned that I was even thinking of going to Mississippi in 1964 for the Mississippi Summer Project, they said I'd lost my mind, you know, that anybody going there had a death wish.
The Mississippi Summer Project, which came to be known as Freedom Summer, was organized by four major civil rights organizations. Treading into perilous waters, the organizers recruited 1,000 college students nationwide, some black, but the vast majority white, many from top schools. The hope was that with integrated participation, parents of the white students might get the ear of authorities and help protect all the young activists. Zohara Simmons was assigned to establish a freedom school in the town of Laurel, Mississippi, southeast of Jackson.
I had this name of a woman named Mrs. Eberta Spinks, and I went to the door, I knocked on it, and I was still, you know, I'd never done anything like this before, and I think I was stumbling with who to tell her I was. And she sort of looked me up and down, and she said, "Girl, are you one of those freedom riders?" And I didn't know if that was good or bad. And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, come in here, girl. I've been waiting on you all my life. And she was in her late 50s. And that was the beginning of the Laurel Project.
Meridian, Mississippi, August 7th, 1964, the funeral of James Cheney, one of three Freedom Summer volunteers, all murdered in acts of terrorism, all in their early 20s. Fanatical white segregationists in the South deeply resented what they saw as an invasion of interlopers from the North, who disrespected long-standing local customs.
Our first building was firebombed, and the fire department would not put it out, so we lost books and all kinds of equipment. And it was very hard then to get another place because people were afraid to rent to us.
Were the people who perpetrated the bombing ever prosecuted?
No. I mean, nobody even cared to look into it. It was totally, nobody cared. That's how it was.
With the eyes of the nation now watching, Freedom Summer continued in Mississippi, with its young participants sobered, frightened, but undeterred.
We were knocking on people's doors. We were speaking in churches. We were having mass meetings, explaining to people what we were doing. And the people were all for it.
Because of the deeply entrenched pattern of voter intimidation, less than 7% of Mississippi's African-American citizens were registered to vote, the lowest percentage of any state. The goal of Freedom Summer was to show America that more blacks would register if they could do so in safety.
On the days that had been decided all across the state, we had mock voter registration centers set up. These were in churches, places that black people had control over. And so this, the word was out across the state, and so thousands of black people participated in this process.
And within a year, the nation responded. President Lyndon B. Johnson addressing Congress, March 1965.
Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote.
Exactly 100 years after hostilities ceased in America's bloody Civil War, President Lyndon B. Johnson stood in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol on the day he signed the historic Voting Rights Act of 1965.
3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived at Jamestown. They came in darkness, and they came in chains. And today, we strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds.
Until the Voting Rights Act, most black Americans in the Deep South were effectively prevented from voting through intimidation and prejudicial local voting rules. Now, under the Act, election procedures in states with a documented history of voter suppression would be supervised by the federal courts. Jurisdictions covered by the new system could be sued under Section 2 of the law if they practiced voter discrimination.
Under that formula, covered jurisdictions, which have less than 25% of the nation's total population, they account for 56% of all successful published Section 2 lawsuits.
Justice Elena Kagan, at a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court hearing on whether the jurisdictions covered by the Voting Rights Act should remain under federal supervision.
If you do that on a per capita basis, the successful Section 2 lawsuits, 4 times higher in covered jurisdictions than in non-covered jurisdictions. The formula seems to be working pretty well in terms of going after the actual violations on the ground and who's committing them.
And Congress, by very large majorities, had repeatedly renewed the Voting Rights Act, much to the chagrin of Justice Antonin Scalia.
I think it is attributed, very likely attributable, to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution.
But that summer, as the nation prepared to mark the emotional 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's March on Washington for Civil Rights, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, invalidated federal supervision of the 9 covered states. Chief Justice John Roberts maintained our country has changed. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell then strongly disagreed.
The concern I have now is that many states are putting in place procedures and new legislation that in some ways makes it a little bit harder to vote. You need a photo ID. Well, you didn't need a photo ID for decades before. Is it really necessary now? And they claim that there's widespread abuse and voter fraud, but nothing substantiates that. There isn't widespread abuse.
The premise for requiring that voters show photo identification when they come to their polling place is to discourage voter impersonation, a fraudulent practice when someone claims to be a registered voter they are not. But meeting the ID requirements restricts who may vote. And that begs the question of whether the restriction is truly justified. So how much voter impersonation is there?
There's no central database. The federal government doesn't keep track of this. The Republican National Lawyers Group had compiled their own list just from news reports from around the country of voting fraud prosecutions. So that was very limited. Nobody else was counting this up.
Leonard Downey served as executive editor of the Washington Post for 17 years. He's now professor of journalism at Arizona State University in Phoenix and leads a national consortium of students at 11 universities, which in 2012 researched the incidence of voter impersonation in the United States.
So we did have to query all 50 states, and it meant going to attorneys general where that was appropriate, to secretaries of state where they're in charge of election laws, wherever was necessary in the various states. It often meant going back and forth many times with those queries. We wound up sending out 2,000 public records requests. We then followed up on the data that we got with by perusing court documents, 5,000 court documents, and other kinds of official records, in order to come up with the most extensive collection of U.S. election fraud cases ever compiled. And still to this day, it's the only one.
The young researchers were guided by a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with an expertise in compiling information for a database. They tracked voter fraud cases for the 12-year period ending in 2011. The project offered real-world training for journalism students, and even more interesting was what their research found.
It showed that there were only 10 instances of voter impersonation at the polls during that entire period in all 50 states.
So given the span of a dozen years whose data was being surveyed, that comes to less than one case of in-person voter fraud per year nationwide.
That's correct.
On average.
That's correct.
So that's an astoundingly low number.
Yes, it is. And what we found was we found more than 2,000 instances of voter fraud of various kinds all around the country, but only 10 of those cases were impersonation. Most of the rest were actually organized. That is to say, they weren't carried out by voters themselves, but carried out by election workers or people who are collecting absentee ballots. In other words, it wasn't individual voters. It was other people trying to rig elections. Absentee ballot fraud was definitely the largest amount of voter fraud that we found.
But the requirement that individuals present ID when they go to the polls has now been adopted by 2/3 of the states. And Leonard Downey finds these rules have a disproportionate impact on certain groups, including minorities.
Some of those states that passed these laws, you know, it's almost any kind of ID is acceptable, and it's not really going to disadvantage anyone. But other states have more restrictive laws. You have to have a state-issue photo ID of a certain kind. In some cases, it had to come from the Motor Vehicles Department. So in a state like Texas, not every county. Texas has so many counties and such long distances, and not even every county even has a motor vehicle office. So in order to acquire the right kind of identification, you have to travel very long miles. And if you don't have a car, or if you're in a part of the state that that is particularly disadvantaged in terms of state services, or if you're a university student trying to figure out what you do. If you're older, if you're disabled, again, it's much more difficult for you to get to where it is that you need to acquire this identification.
So there are these obstacles for people. Why do those obstacles disproportionately impact certain populations, notably minorities, seniors, and others?
Well, it's, you know, it's access to transportation, obviously, access to the offices where you need to go to get the identification. For older African Americans, it's the difficulty of obtaining a birth certificate because in many cases there were no birth certificates. They were born at home.
Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Pretty mamas in Avalon want me there all the time.
You know, everybody has their own history and their own legacy.
Myrna Perez monitors ballot access trends for New York University's Brennan Center for Justice.
There was a time where, you know, African Americans in many parts of the South weren't being allowed to be born in hospitals. And so, you know, if their birth certificate is really just some notation by a midwife, that may or may not be accurate, may or may not be accepted by the state, you know, that person is not going to, you know, is going to have a really hard time getting an ID.
Almost all states with voter ID requirements are controlled by Republican legislatures. Democrats cry that the ID rules are a thinly veiled form of suppression of minority voters steeped in a long tradition. But Trey Grayson, a Republican who served as Secretary of State for the Commonwealth of Kentucky and went on to teach at Harvard, says the concept of voter ID is bipartisan.
I'd point to the Carter Baker Commission after the 2004 election, which called for a heightened voter identification requirement. And I'd say that if people are so concerned about the vote, not having voter IDs, if we spend as much time on this issue of actually trying to get them those IDs, we wouldn't be having this debate. And then I guess if I were to say to somebody on the right who's saying this is the most important issue, I'd say, like, wait a minute, if this were really, really important, we'd see it in the data if it were that urgent. And why don't you phase this in and help people get IDs?
But for now, requiring that voters bring identification to the polls may pose a real obstacle for at least some citizens, says Myrna Perez of the Brennan Center.
I think anybody that has been in the very bad situation of, like, losing a license, a driver's license, will know that it's not a cakewalk. It's not something that's easy to do. It's something that most of us have the resources to overcome because most of us, you know, have the ability to scramble up a bunch of different documents and can stand in line and get to the DMV office. But there are some people that can't.
This question has been tested in various courts, yielding somewhat mixed results. Judges in Georgia and Indiana did not conclude that voter ID requirements reduced voter participation. But in 2014, courts in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin struck down ID laws in those states, finding the ID requirement could deter hundreds of thousands of citizens from voting. Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Corbett.
People have forgotten about it, but there were polls in the past, 87% of the people came out that we should have voter ID. I believe that we should have ID with us all the time. Secondly, this is making it clear that you have one person, one vote, one time. And the voter ID is a way, and photo ID is a way of ensuring that. Has there been voter fraud in the past? Yes, there's been legal cases in the Senate race back in the 1990s. There was one, and I forget the name of the gentleman, that there was a voter fraud issue going on at that time. It makes sure that one person votes one time and that they are the person who they say they are.
Indeed, a Washington Post poll from 2012 shows a majority of Americans favor photo ID requirements for voters. And for many people, use of IDs is not a big deal. It's commonplace in driving cars and at venues like banks and airports.
But Myrna Perez from NYU says when it comes to voting, special care must be taken to safeguard the rights of low-income populations.
For the vast majority of Americans, it is not a big deal. The vast majority of Americans have access to either an ID that would qualify, or they have the kind of job that would let them take a day off of work and stand in line at the DMV. But we do know that a sizable amount of eligible Americans, between 8 and 12%, do not have the kind of identification that would require. People that don't have cars, that don't have flexible work schedules, people that have onerous responsibilities in terms of their family with respect to childcare, or people that don't understand the rules, people that don't have access to the underlying documents. And I think when we are discussing different state laws, we need to ask ourselves, how many barriers in front of the ballot box are we willing to put? And what is the data, what is the evidence demanding that we do so?
But the debate over voter ID rules tells only part of the story. The Pew Center on the States reported in 2012 that America's voter registration system is riddled with errors. One in eight registrations, according to Pew, is inaccurate or invalid, including dead people listed as active voters. Others are registered in more than one state simultaneously. Leonard Downey of Arizona State.
We knew at the time of our reporting that Pew was undertaking the study and that they were finding big problems with voter registration, but we did not find people voting as those dead people. We did not find people voting in more than one state. But most of this were, you know, people innocently moving from one state to another, as happens in the United States, and they started voting in their new state and did not do anything to take themselves off the registration rolls in their old state, and the states don't talk to each other about this.
And then there's plain old electoral corruption, which is found on both sides of the aisle. Former Kentucky Secretary of State Trey Grayson.
There's a county in rural Kentucky, Clay County. When those voting machines were replaced, the county clerk used the opportunity to instruct the poll workers to give incorrect instructions to the voters on how to use the new voting systems. And they basically told them when they were finished, when they saw an American flag, as opposed to when the machine said they were finished, and that allowed the votes to be flipped. And on election day, we got a bunch of calls, and there are a whole bunch of people now in jail for participating in this scheme.
You're listening to The Right to Vote, a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. To obtain an audio download or a CD of this documentary, to hear portions of interviews not included in the program, and to access related educational resources, please visit humanmedia.org.
On behalf of the State Elections Canvassing Commission, and in accordance with the laws of the state of Florida, I hereby declare Governor George W. Bush the winner of Florida's 25 electoral votes for the President of the United States.
The cliffhanger presidential election of 2000. It was a surreal moment of butterfly ballots and hanging chads. The nation watched a dizzying volley of state and federal court rulings over whether Al Gore or George W. Bush would take the White House. 12 years later, with Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on the presidential ballot, a sense of electoral confusion again pervaded some voting precincts in Florida, with widespread reports of equipment breakdowns and dauntingly long lines.
People were willing to stand in line 7, 8, 9 hours to cast a vote.
University of Florida Professor Zohara Simmons.
People on walkers. Folks had to bring chairs out, you know, for them to sit on. I mean, it was unbelievable. There were all kinds of people being challenged. People who had voted previously, no problem. Then they get up there and they say, well, we can't find your name, or, you know, it's another issue.
Florida remains a lightning rod for criticism over election procedure. An aggressive state program to purge non-citizens from the voting rolls, championed in 2011 by Republican Governor Rick Scott, provoked fierce reaction from immigrant groups who saw it as an assault on Hispanic voters. Marta Marcano, a native of Puerto Rico now living in Jacksonville, says she received a voter registration card, but when she checked it online, her name was missing from the rolls.
I find out I was purged out of the list, and I never received a letter. I never received a notification.
She says her name was eventually reinstated upon request, but she felt harassed when she voted at a local polling place in 2012 and now prefers to vote by mail using an absentee ballot. Ironically, Marta had once served as an election official in Puerto Rico.
A melting pot means that a lot of people from another country came here and made their life here. They made this country a real nation. So we're part of this nation, and we're proud to be an American citizen.
In 2012, the U.S. Department of Justice sued Florida, alleging that its voter purge policies violated federal voting rights law. And in 2014, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder raised an additional concern about access to the ballot box.
Across this country today, an estimated 5.8 million Americans, 5.8 million of our fellow citizens, are prohibited from voting because of current or previous felony convictions. Now, that's more than the individual populations of 31 United States, 31 of our states. And although well over a century has passed since post-Reconstruction states used these measures to strip African Americans of their most fundamental rights, the impact of felony disenfranchisement on modern communities of color remains both disproportionate and unacceptable.
Holder estimated that about 1 in 13 African American adults in the U.S. is barred from voting under the disenfranchisement of felons. In 3/4 of states, felons automatically regain their voting rights upon completing their sentence. That was true for nonviolent offenders in Florida, but in 2011, the policy was changed to impose a waiting period of at least 5 years.
How they got it saying that all felons is the same as hardcore felons. That's a difference.
In Jacksonville, Talmadge Terrell Core, known as Red Dog, has worked as a cook and a construction worker. He was sentenced to 15 years in federal and state prisons for drug trafficking and released in 2007. Red Dog says it's been a long and bumpy road.
I ain't killed nobody. I ain't raped nobody. I sold drugs. So that's under nonviolent crime. So you telling me a nonviolent crime felon is the same as a hardcore felon? I understand I did wrong, okay? We all paying our debts to society. Living in life that, hey, once my debt is paid, it's supposed to be, everything's supposed to be giving my rights back to me in full.
Why is it important to you to vote?
It's important to me because that's where you get changes from. That's where everybody on this earth can prosper beside the upper class. When I call the upper class, the rich folks and all that. Middle class poor want to prosper too. So if that's the only way I can get my voice heard is through voting, I want to do that.
I've heard terms thrown around like public safety, but how would someone trying to engage positively in the civil process a threat to public safety?
Devin Coleman wore a T-shirt bearing the word author when we met in Jacksonville. While doing time at the Florida Department of Corrections for burglary and assault, he wrote a book entitled Prisoner to Poet, Thoughts of an Incarcerated Soul. Devin was released in 2006.
When you look at other states, so many other states have laws to which ex-offenders can get their rights back, whether it be at the end of sentence, at the end of probation, parole, restitution. Why is it that Florida doesn't have a law like that? And when you look at how many people in Florida can't vote, you wonder why, especially when you got a debatable like Gore and Bush, right, in several elections since. Florida is a swing state. So is it really a public safety issue or a control issue?
Today, Devin Coleman works with voting rights advocacy groups, including Florida New Majority and Florida Rights Restoration Coalition.
It's a funny feeling to want to be able to participate in something productive and cannot because of a mistake that you made however many years ago. I currently fall up under the new guidelines in the state of Florida. You have to wait 5 to 7 years before you can even apply to get the right to vote back.
If you have a felony conviction.
Right. And that 5 to 7 year wait depends on the offense. My offense falls in the category of 7 years. So I have to wait 7 years to apply for the right to vote. And then that board that presides over that hearing has an infinite timeline in which to get back to me concerning that application. I've heard stories of people waiting, you know, a total of 13 years to get a response.
Some academic research shows that restoring voting rights to felons is associated with a lower likelihood the ex-offender will repeat criminal behavior. Some probation officials believe that voting can strengthen a person's ties with the community. I asked citizens about this question outside a Winn-Dixie grocery store in Stark, Florida.
When you go against our laws, a felony is not smoking pot. It's a serious charge. They know before you commit a serious crime, this is what you can get. This is one of your penalties. Therefore, when they do that, as far as I'm concerned, their rights now become limited.
Permanently.
Permanently. Because they know to start with. If you do a felony, you go in there and shoot up a cash register or a cashier, take the money, come out, get charged, serve your time because you didn't kill nobody, but you're going to get some time.
So how do we rehabilitate prisoners in a manner that they are then integrated back into society and are not committing crimes and are behaving responsibly?
How do you rehabilitate them? You don't. I've never seen anybody rehabilitated yet.
I think they should be able to regain their rights because they paid their debt to society. You know, if they took away all of our rights, if you did something wrong, you know, nobody is perfect in this world. We all make mistakes. We're human. Nobody is perfect but Christ himself. So.
May I ask, do you work for a living?
Yes, sir, I do.
What do you do?
I work at the prison.
You work at the prison?
Been on 28 years.
May I ask what you do?
I'm a captain.
A guard?
Yes, sir.
Do you think granting somebody the right to vote would aid in their rehabilitation?
Oh, yes, it would help.
Because?
Because it would show that they're getting responsibilities back and that their opinion is valuable to the community.
The debate over who may vote in the world's most powerful democracy goes to the core of American constitutional rights, which we continue to reinterpret as times change. It also goes to how we understand human rights. University of Florida Religion and African American Studies professor Zohara Simmons.
You know, compared to where we were, we have moved substantially, but of course there are the forces that are constantly trying to pull us backwards. But my profound longing is for a society where we truly could see each and every human being as a magnificent manifestation of God's creation, and that that person is a reflection of myself. And the thing that we always learned as children, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If that could become something that we all imbibed, I think it would be possible to develop a society where people are judged by what they bring to the effort of building a society, and that we also provide for those who don't contribute and try and help them become contributing members.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg, studio recording by Antonio.
Antonio Oliart-Rose, associate producer Mark Kilstein, editorial assistants from Lisa Mullins, Thomas Royal, and Kathy Graham, webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org.